Warning, this podcast contains some swearing. Welcome to the Roy Harper Podcast. This is episode number 17 for December 2008. And I guess it's our Christmas episode, where there won't be any jingle bells or any of that kind of stuff. In this show, we'll have a news update first of all, and then we'll have part two of a two-part interview with Bill Musial, the A to Z of Harper. This time it's the letter P, some listener feedback and some music. And again, like last month, the interview is pretty long, so there'll be a little bit less music than usual, but I hope that the interview will make up for it, because I think it's a pretty good one. And first of all, news-wise, there's a couple of things to report. A great article appeared on the online edition of Taiwan News, where Roy Harper answered 20 questions. It's a good mixture of topics and some very illuminating answers from Roy about a variety of topics. I've put a link to it on the front page of stormcock.net, and I'll also put a link to it in the show notes of this podcast, and I strongly encourage you to go and have a read of that. It gives a really good idea of what Roy's up to now, what his priorities are, things he's into, things that have inspired him, that kind of stuff. Really good. And the second thing is Nick Harper is busy preparing a tour for the forthcoming months, and dates are coming in from time to time. The best place to find out what's going on so you can plan ahead for Nick is to look on the forums at stormcock.net, where Nick's PR lady Lynn is busy feeding us dates as they come, and eventually, of course, there'll be a proper list of them up on the main site. But that's a good place to go to if you want advanced information. Okay, and we're going to head straight into the first track, and I was thinking about the editors of Harper and P again, and I've picked a particular track for certain reasons, which I'll explain later on. But I also thought about Psychopath from the Dream Society, and the Dream Society is an album that I actually really like, and it's kind of got mixed opinions about it, but the production's good, the songs are good, the playing's great. Roy's voice was back to top form, I think, and Psychopath is a song I particularly like. One of the reasons I like it is because I can remember when he played at the Spitz in East London, and somebody called out for Psychopath, and he said, "What? Psychopath?" Not Psychopath, I should say, in a northern accent. And I don't know, it's just me, but I found it funny. I don't get out of the home, and I'm not that good at school. I want to be a singer, but they tell me that's not cool. So I'm leaving in the morning, and I'll be on my way with my guitar and my rucksack. I'll be back someday. I need another world to find that winding road with an open mind. I won't leave this psychopath behind. Now on to the interview. And one thing to bear in mind about this is we recorded it a few days before the American elections. And Bill, of course, being an American, had some opinions on that. And it's very interesting to listen to the interview in the light of what happened since. Obviously, Obama did win, and we're very pleased about that. And also, the whole world's financial systems continue to go to hell. So, anyway, enjoy. Stepping away from Roy, briefly, I love finding out what people listen to other than Roy, because I know we're all here because of a common musical interest. But, you know, the musical field is so varied. I really like to find out what other stuff people are into. And I know that you have got a very, very diverse taste. So could you give me like a few artists that you would like to recommend to people listening to this that are into Roy's music?
That are into Roy's music?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, where to begin? Well, I'm way into the British folk rock. So, you know, people that are into Roy that like the British folk rock would like other British people like Michael Chapman. You know, you got your Bert Johnsons and your John Renborns. I'm gone into the music room here. I'm looking at the CDs and records on the walls. Actually, I think we're going to get fuzzy there if I go in there. I'm also thinking of females.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of females that are not that well known in the UK that I really like. There's a woman from the East Coast of America called Happy Rhodes.
Yeah, I've got all of her stuff.
Do you?
And she is wonderful.
Did Nick Lane turn you on to her?
No, it was completely independent, actually. And I happened to mention to Nick Happy Rhodes because I downloaded an album from eMusic legally through a subscription. And it's just brilliant. And so I went on a search to find all the rest of it.
I mean, I will get back to this in a second, but to talk about Roy and his influence, after I got back from that trip in 92, Roy has had such a huge influence in my life because shortly thereafter, I ended up meeting a guy who I actually heard, believe it or not, One of Those Days in England's Parts 2 through 10 on the radio. The next summer.
That's not something
and
I can
said,
say.
Wow, this often. Is a cool radio station. I mean, they're playing the 20-minute sidelong track on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, I got to meet this DJ. And I went and met the DJ at the local really cool hip FM station. And it's now my 14-year best friend, Drew Ross. We've gone and interviewed Roy since then. And, you know, we're best friends. We've done Roy Harper special together. He was the program director of the station. Because of that Roy song and Roy's influence, I ended up doing a radio show for 5 years called Mr. Bill's Wild Ride, where I did, you know, annual Roy Harper, six-hour Roy Harper specials.
Good man.
got into you know, music really, really hardcore, and, you know, I've done radio off and on since. And it's just been a great thing. So Roy's, you know, musical influence has spread that way, too. And so that's how I got into Happy Rhodes. There was a sampler that came into the station, and they just got hooked on her. She's amazing. Very kind of Kate Bush meets Peter Gabriel and David Bowie, somewhere down that kind of Roy Harper progressive vein. Like the Straubs lot. Great band. I've seen Dave Cousins a couple times locally. He's fantastic. A lot of the American, you know, standards of Joni Mitchell's fantastic, and Neil Young, that kind of stuff. I'm trying to think more eclectic people and new people. Gosh, I can't believe it.
Have you heard Joanna Newsom yet?
What?
Have you heard Joanna Newsom yet?
Yeah. I like her. Is it Ease album?
Yeah,
I like that album a lot. I remember when I first heard it, the vocals were a little radical, but I like that album a lot. She's a San Francisco, originally San Francisco based and more local.
I don't know whether you knew she played the Albert Hall last year and had Roy's support.
Oh yeah, I know all about that. I was jealous as all hell that I couldn't be there.
Yeah, that was really something.
One of the worst things about being a hardcore Roy Harper fan on the West Coast of America is that, you know, we get bloody all shows over here.
Yeah.
I mean, from 1986 to 1996, the first 10 years of my Harper addiction, it was 10 years before I ever saw him live.
Oh, dear.
Before he finally played here. I finally saw him in 96, I think it was, at McCabe's in California.
Yeah.
And got to see him play. and that was great. And I think I saw him maybe four times between 96 and 98.
Yeah.
And that was it. And he hasn't been back since in the last 10 years. So it was like I got a couple years of quick fixes and then nothing.
Yeah, pretty raw deal.
And, you know, to see him do all of Stormcock live with at that John on Newsroom show would have been, you know,
right.
Just one of the greatest shows of my life. You saw that, I think.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, it was good?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. You don't need to say anything else, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, I like John Newsom a lot.
I
like a lot of, I try to keep up on new groups. There's a group called Fleet Foxes. Have you heard of them?
No.
Hmm?
No.
Yeah, they're kind of a trippy group like Espers. They're kind of nice. I like them a lot. Can't believe I'm going. I like My Morning Jacket.
I know of them, but I've not heard them.
They did an album a couple years ago called Z, which was really good. I got hooked on that. Their new one called Evil Urges, they did a couple of songs on early on the album that have a kind of a weird high Prince vocal type thing I didn't like at all.
Yeah.
And I dismissed the album, and then I put it on repeat in my car player, and it's an amazing sounding album. That the second half of the album is just mind-blowingly good, and it just grows on you. It's a really, really good album. Highly recommended. So that's My Morning Jacket.
Oh, I'll check them out. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else. You know, I'm way into the classics of classic rock.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's Roy, there's Tull, and then a lot of obscure singer-songwriters, and I'm drawing a blank on. There's a British guy, Colin Scott. You ever heard of him?
No.
He only released one album in 71 of all years, my great year.
Yeah.
That, you know, has like Peter Gabriel and Peter Hamill and a bunch of odd people on it. And it actually just came out on CD, I think, last year.
Really?
Really good, worth searching out. I like Keith Christmas, who did an album called...
Oh, yeah. I've got two of his albums. Very good.
Yeah, it's real good. There's a whole bunch of obscure British guys from the late 60s that are real good. Another female is Katel Kinnick, or something like that, who released a couple albums in the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
And then a third album in the early 2000s, who's a great... I think she might be a Breton-ish or something like that. Used to hang out in the mid-90s with that whole Jeff Buckley scene in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And was a backup singer for Natalie Merchant. And Natalie actually did one of her songs, Gulf of Araby. Amazing vocalist. Saw her live at Largo, where Roy played in L.A.
Right.
A while back, and she's really, really good. Katel Kinnick, worth getting.
Oh, okay, good.
So there's a lot of great music out there, and I'm just going to...
No, you're just skimming it. Did you ever get into John Martin? Are you a John Martin fan?
Oh, yeah, huge. Yeah, I got all his records.
Right.
Love his stuff. Like his stuff with his wife a lot.
Yeah.
You know, my faves are Bless the Weather and Solid Air. But I like his early stuff before his wife. You know, big fan of his stuff.
Right.
Never got that much into, you know, the stuff from even One World On.
Oh, the sort of funky stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm a huge fan of his early stuff. I mean, Bless the Weather, to me, is just an amazing album. And, of course, Solid Air is a stone cold classic. Huge Nick Drake fan.
I was just going to mention Nick, yeah.
One of my pride and joys is I have British pressings on Pink Island of his three albums.
Right.
Actually, two of them are Pink Rim labels, which is, as a collector, you know, like second pressings. But they're still highly collectible mint copies and... You know, for the record collector, that's the kind of stuff they shoot their wad on. So, yeah, I'm a huge Nick Drake fan, and I have all his stuff. And I even asked Roy when I interviewed him once about if he had met Nick and all that, and he mentioned, you know, meeting him on the street and talking to him and just kind of how distant he was and wondering if he could have connected to him on another level or something, you know.
Well, if anybody's listening to this that hasn't heard Nick Drake, you know, stop the podcast now and go and buy it, because it is just terrific. I can
you
know.
All three of his albums. My favorite of his three actually is Pink Moon.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Peter Buck said it best. It's kind of the British version of Robert Johnson's Hellhound on Your Trail. I mean,
right.
Obviously, the first two albums are beautiful. They're lushly produced with John Boyd's production, Joe Boyd's production. And John Wood is an amazing engineer.
Yes.
And I love those albums, don't get me wrong, but the purity of Pink Moon, just, I mean, recorded And again, it's 1971. It was recorded in November, two nights, late at night, just Nick and John Wood on the engineer done, and then just left there in London at the Island Studios and then released early to, in February of
72
to no fanfare. I mean, it's just pure, pure Nick.
You know?
And then later on to come out with a Black Eyed Dog, you know, it's just, I mean, to me that's just like, it's the scary stuff.
Mm. It's quite chilling, actually, sometimes.
It is. Yeah. I take it you like the earlier albums?
Oh, I do, but I vary between liking Five Leaves Left or Pink Moon. I think Brighter Later is a bit too overproduced, but...
Yeah.
On balance, I think Pink Moon probably has the edge, actually. So, I'm on your side there. Okay, changing the subject again.
You know, another artist I love, and I think is underrated, is Donovan.
Oh, now that's interesting, because a lot of people are really, really write him off as just being too sort of twee, does that, if you know what twee means.
Yeah, I know what it means.
Yeah.
No, I think that, he's obviously early on pegged as, you know, a Dylan, poor man's Dylan.
Yeah.
But I think that the stuff he did circa Sunshine Superman was heavily influential on the Beatles, you know, and he was part of that whole Beatles scene. And I think most people that don't, or maybe too young, or don't remember because it was too hazy, that period around 66, 67, he was huge and as influential as the Beatles around 66, 67 with Sunshine Superman. I mean, that's a kind of an acid Bible type album.
Right.
And you know, he was getting busted for pot at the same time as them. They were all writing those heavily surrealistic poetry type lyrics that I talked about earlier with Dylan. He did get a little poppy with the Mickey Mouse type production stuff in the late 60s, but I think he really, really, really hit his mark with 1970's Open Road, which is my favorite Donna album. Are you familiar with this album?
No, I've only got a kind of best of collection.
Oh, well, that's the one you need to go out and get, because if you like your Nick Drake and your Harpers, this is like the unsung Donovan album. It came out in 1970. In the UK, it was on the Don label, which is a very obscure British label, Epic in America. But it's on Don in the UK, and it's available on CD now on Repertoire.
Okay.
And it's called Open Road, and it's his kind of, he left Mickey Mouse's production behind. He got together a very small band, and it's just his pure Celtic album. I actually got to interview him once in the late 90s in the Fillmore backstage right before a show. In my DJ days, and he was a very nice guy, and I talked to him about Open Road. To him, that was like his kind of pure, he called it his punk album, which...
It's not
really punk. I mean, the music is...
But the feeling
rock,
of it, you mean.
Really.
Yeah.
But it's much more edgier than the kind of poppy 60s production sound. And it's very pure. I mean, and there's a couple of songs that are a little weird. I wouldn't call it fae, but they're, you know, that kind of Donovan strangeness to them. But there's some songs on there that are just radical. It's probably his most Harper-esque album as far as lyrics that are poking at society. There's a song called Poke at the Pope. It's pretty funny. It's a great album. Highly recommended, Open Road. And then kind of after that, he lost the plot in the 70s.
Right.
And, you know, he never really, ever recovered. But that's definitely the gem that's lost. It's almost like his Stormcock in the fact that it's this great album that nobody knows about.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to get that.
Yeah, you won't regret it.
Perhaps I should talk about Dylan briefly, because you've mentioned Dylan quite a lot. And I'm a bit embarrassed to admit this, but I can't stand listening to it. I cannot listen to Dylan's music. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of it, and I can listen to the odd track, but I can't listen to a whole album. And this is a really silly thing to say, but I think it's just I think he's a terrific songwriter, but I just can't take the music. I can't take the voice.
The voice.
Yeah, and I've tried and tried and tried. It's the voice. I've tried so many times, Bill, to tune into it, and I just can't do it. And I think I'm mentioning that because some people have said that about Roy as well, that his voice they can't take.
Well, I don't have a problem with either of their voices. I could see where people would have an issue with Dylan's voices.
Yeah.
Dylan's voice, you know, I think it's much more an acquired taste than Roy's voice. I mean, Roy has much more a rich, a resonant voice that a lot of people would find much more acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people have trouble with Donovan's voice and, you know, Neil Young's voice.
Oh, yeah,
so
that's true.
So there are different vocal styles, but of those, I think definitely the most challenging vocal style is Dylan's. But you can't, I mean, he was born with the voice he has, and I think the important thing about having the voice he has is that he had important things to say. I mean, almost more important than any other person in rock history.
Yeah.
Maybe the most important voice in rock history so far. And the fact that he didn't let the fact that he couldn't sing worse than shit, in some people's opinions, get in his way is you know, almost the most important thing he had to say, freedom-wise.
Mm.
Because, I mean, the guy literally revolutionized rock and gave a voice to a generation and changed rock and roll forever. I mean, you can't... Just the fact that he influenced the Beatles, and the Beatles influenced everything else, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is enough to say that this man is maybe the most important person in rock and roll history. I mean, and he had a huge influence on Roy. Roy couldn't deny that and wouldn't deny that.
No, he doesn't. You know? He says how much of a catalyst Dylan was.
So, you know, you kind of have to let the voice thing go. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and if you can't... If you have a hard time with the voice, I understand that, but the words are too important to not appreciate it.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I'm a big fan of doing covers, so you listen to other people do it. You know, there's a lot of great Dylan songs that are done by Fairport Convention.
Yeah,
Sammy
yeah,
Denny
that's
is
true.
A great interpreter of Dylan songs. And you know, there's a lot of great people have done covers, and that's a good way to get into it, is you can appreciate it is done by somebody else. Almost every Dylan song has been done by somebody else, so that might be a way around it. But for me, you know, as far as Dylan goes, you got the early folk protest albums, which I'm actually not one to ever put those on. You know, I know that Freewheeling Bob Dylan and The Times Are Changing are two seminal, very important albums in, you know, history. I never listened to them. I have them, never listened to them.
Right.
To me, the trilogy of Bring It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blah 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 is, you know, like, this is like the Holy Trinity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like the foundation stones of everything that came after, and it's pretty hard to beat those anywhere. And it's really kind of where rock and roll for me starts. The golden age of classic rock from 65 to 75 starts right there.
Right.
And you can throw, you know, Rubber Soul and Revolver into that mix too, and that's kind of where it begins right there. And speaking of 65, when you and I were born, that's when Highway 61 Revisited was recorded, you know, June, July, August 65, right around the time we were born. So, I mean, that's really kind of, we came out when that came out, and that's really where, you know, like a Rolling Stone, from then on, rock and roll was never the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of Dylan that's like the second coming was, of course, Blood on the Tracks, Desire,
10
years later in 75. I would think that for somebody like you who has a hard time with the voice, Blood on the Tracks might be a more easier, palatable album.
I have got that. I think I've only listened to it once, so perhaps I should give it another try. You know,
you should try that one. Unfortunately, the best version of Blood on the Tracks is not the one he released. He had a second guess. It's the same thing Roy did with Death or Glory. He put out the first version and then rethunk it and changed it. Although Dylan's version, he rethunk it before he actually put it out, and the version that you have of Blood on the Tracks is the one that came out, and it's not as good as the
I get you.
Was unreleased, which you can still get those tracks now, and I think the unreleased version is the better vocal takes and the better album.
Uh-huh.
Whereas with Death or Glory, of course, it got changed after the fact.
Yeah.
But, Blood on the Tracks is maybe a much more accessible album than those earlier Dylan albums I was telling you about, but I don't know what to tell you about your Dylan vocal disease.
Disease.
I understand it, but I can't cure you from it.
No.
It's too important not to listen to, and maybe you just take your pill with some, you know, with a different artist singing it. You know, that way you can get the medicine you need. You know what I mean?
Thank you, Dr. Bill. My standard question next, which is, what the hell is going to happen to the music industry in the future? Are the big labels dead? Is the internet the killer or the savior of music? Any views?
Oh, yeah, it's totally fucked. I think the music industry, you know, definitely as we know it, is dead.
Yeah.
it's really sad for me because, to me, music is so important. And I think as a cultural, I mentioned this earlier, as a cultural identifier, you know, an identity of yourself and the others, if you need to have an us and them, dichotomy is pretty important in the world. And I think that at a certain point, rock music was, you know, a unifier of a generation. And I think that record stores and having that kind of communal outlet was very important to our generation and, you know, our parents' generation.
It was.
You know, that era. And I think that there's just a different world now. And I look at it, my own kids. I have my older kids are 20, and my daughter just turned 19 yesterday.
Yeah.
And they just don't see the world the same. I mean, it's just a whole different world for them. They have their iPods, and they download things for free, and they don't buy CDs, and they don't have any problem with the morality of downloading things for free. They think it's stupid to buy CDs in a store.
Right.
They don't have any problem with the stores going out of business. You know, I am lucky enough to live near a college town where I grew up, where there's still two independent record stores. And that is a rarity, because in America, there was, I think this is around 2000, we had about 10,000 independent record stores left in 2000. Since then, the big box stores like Best Buy and Target and those places and the downloading thing have just crushed that.
Yeah.
There's about two-thirds of them gone, and we have about 3,000 or 4,000 left. And for me to have two around locally is just a rarity. They're disappearing like, you know, nothing. And the only way they're still surviving is internet sales and diversifying into other things.
Right.
You know, like weird little memorabilia type things, or, you know, my local store is now selling like Monty Python detachable arm dolls. Like, it's only a flesh wound. Kind of crap, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, it's really sad because I love the communal aspect of record stores.
Yeah.
Flipping through. I like the physical product. I like records and I like CDs. And there's nothing like holding a record in your hand.
I agree.
Record rack, talking to other people about music, sharing the music, and you lose that whole thing with the internet.
You do.
And whose fault is it? There's plenty of blame to go around. Obviously, with the younger generations, you know, I mean, they're being fed the whole iPod culture, and, you know, the music business blew it with CDs by charging an arm and a leg for a 50-cent disc. They cut their own head off in that respect, so you can't blame the kids for going off and buying free downloads. A great example is the new Dylan release. You know, there's a new Dylan release out, just came out this last week, called the Bootleg Series Volume 8.
Oh, and there's different versions of it, isn't there?
Yeah, it's Volume 8, and it's there's a two-disc set, and then if you want to, you can buy the three-disc set with a book. But the two-disc set is on sale here, where CDs are ridiculously cheap, for like $15.
Yeah.
But if you want to buy the three-disc set for the third disc and the book, it's like $150.
Jesus.
So you're paying like an extra $100 for a third CD and a book. It's ridiculous.
That's a
bit
weird.
And I refuse to do that.
Yeah.
And so what's happening, of course, is that some people bought the third disc, and now you can find it on the internet for free.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I've already traded with, I've got two people online that I'm trading. You know, one guy's trading me some Elvis Costello shows, another guy's trading me, you know, a Richard Thompson show in exchange for a copy of the disc.
Yeah.
And I don't have any problem with that, because I actually went out and bought the vinyl version of the Dylan set for $100 because I'm a vinyl junkie.
Yeah.
And so if I spend $115 on the CD and the vinyl version, I don't have a qualm of trading somebody for this third disc that I was supposed to bend over and pay $100
right.
for. No, thank you.
I felt the same when I replaced some of my vinyl with CD. I didn't buy all of it again, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, the music industry has kind of, you know, shot itself in the ass in that respect. The downloading thing, it gets to the whole issue of progress. The music industry is, you know, a victim of this whole progress thing and the computers and the internet. And I have to say, you know, philosophically speaking, that I think progress is a double-edged sword. And this double-edged sword is being shoved down our throats, and that can be very bloody.
Mm.
And it's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, progress is always championed as a good thing. And yes, there are benefits to the internet, and there are benefits to, you know, a lot of the progressive things that are happening in the world, but there are downsides. And I don't think those downsides are ever really acknowledged and looked at clearly. And it's just always assumed that progress is good and we must go forward. But for everything gained, there is something lost. And, you know, just for example, the internet and us doing our whole you know, instant messaging and emailing and all that stuff, is the lost art of letter writing, you know?
That's true.
Do you remember writing letters 10 years ago to your friends and getting a letter in the post?
Mm, it was quite, you know, it's an exciting thing. And it made you think more about what you had to say.
Yeah, it was important. And it was, I don't know if that's just nostalgia on my part or not, but to me it seemed, I remember relishing when I got a letter in the mail and you'd sit down in the backyard or with a cup of tea or something and crack the letter open and relish reading it and maybe reading it twice and seeing what was in there and just enjoying it. And then, you know, you might feel guilty for a day or a week or a month until you wrote back to that person.
Yeah.
But you would do it and, you know, and they'd love getting the letter back and you feel great when you finally sent it off. And now it's just like, you know, you blast something off and it's, you know, it's gone into the ethernet forever. And sometimes you write stuff you wish you hadn't said.
Mm.
You've been way guilty of that. So,
The
whole, I'm getting off topic here, but the whole progress thing, I'm very dubious of progress. You know, I almost wish we could go back to a time 10 years ago where we didn't have, if not the internet, if we didn't have cell phones, because...
Mm. You are sounding, you're sounding a bit like Patrick McGoohan. I don't know how much you know about Patrick McGoohan from The Prisoner. Yeah, he one of his stated themes for The Prisoner was about progress, and that's why the symbol of The Prisoner was that bicycle. It was an old-fashioned way of getting around.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we're rushing headlong into all of these different new things that are coming without stepping back and thinking about it and thinking about how much it will change everything and whether it's a good thing or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, the bicycle is a good example. It was a great invention that got us, you know, to use Roy's analogy in the Lord's Prayer about speeding up.
Mm.
You know, it's not a horse, it's a bike, but it can go fast enough, but it's man-powered and it's not polluting the atmosphere,
yeah,
etc. We go to cars and all of a sudden, you know, Industrial Revolution and petroleum products and oil, and look where it's got us now, you know? I mean, that's progress, but really...
At what cost?
Not very good, because the byproducts have been pretty bad, considering that, you know, all the greed and wars have been fought over oil since then.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, every one of these things has its consequences, and when you look at what's happening in the world now, it all seems to come down to money and greed and man doing bad things to man over these things, and it's all related to progress. So, you know, I don't think we're going to be able to affect any change on this, unfortunately, and I don't know that the nature of the beast can be changed, so the progress, I don't know, is getting a little negative.
No, I think people have been kind of conditioned by society, if you like, to believe that they're entitled to things without thinking about the consequences or, you know, how other people are affected by it. In the UK, at least, in the last 15 years, 20 years, people have become very selfish and very insular. Well, we're getting on to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about, actually.
Well, let me comment on that.
Yeah.
I do agree with that in the respect that I've always felt that in America and the UK and basically the whole first world, Europe and America, that we live in Disneyland. you know, it really is this fantasy land because there's the rest of the world, the third world and the second world or whatever isn't, you know, the affluent world, is living in kind of what I call the real world, not this fantasy land we live in.
Mm.
And the imperialist West, if you want to call it, has basically gotten as wealthy and as decadent and, you know, living this fantasy life as it has by exploiting the rest of the world. And the strange thing about it is that with the modern world the way it is and global economics and global media is that we've kind of exported entertainment to where the whole world can see what we're living like.
Oh, yes.
But they can't live that way.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like now India and China wants to live the way we live, but the whole world can't live the way we live because we've done it by exploiting it off of their back.
Yeah.
So it's this really bizarre situation where everyone else wants to live the way we live, rightfully so, they would assume, but they can't because they don't realize, or maybe they do realize, that, you know, that we did it by exploiting them as an imperialist countries, you know, decades and centuries ago. So it's this really bad situation, and unfortunately the planet is just fucked over for this reason. And getting back to your point, us in the UK and America, you know, we live in this kind of fantasy land of new toys,
Yeah.
And credit and, you know, getting whatever you want. And we're very spoiled and very self-centered and very insular. And nobody wants to hear the truth. And, you know, I think that our biggest problem is that our governments have realized all this a long time ago. And they've realized that all you have to do is distract and entertain the people enough. And you can just keep on exploiting whatever it is and you can maintain the status quo. So you just keep the people entertained with whatever it is, whether it's, you know, TV or now computers, cell phones, war, whatever it is, keep them distracted enough, keep them happy enough with just a taste of the good life, and you can maintain power and control and the status quo and keep reaping in your riches to where 5% have all the wealth and the rest of the people are happy enough that they're not like the rest of the world that's, you know, starving and poor. And it reminds me of the Roger Waters album, Amused to Death.
Yeah.
Where they basically find us in the, you know, next century. They find our shadows huddled around TV screens. And we've all died, and their shadows are, you know, we amused ourselves to death because we basically didn't stop and look and fix the problems in the world until it was too late. And we all died because we all amused ourselves to death and got entertained to death or distracted to death, whether it was through TV or now I think the internet is our latest distraction. And I think it's, you know, a sad commentary, but I think that the people in charge will keep doing it as long as we let them. And unfortunately, the only way to change that is through revolution, and revolution is not really a plausible, viable, healthy alternative.
The village TV hooks its viewers on giveaway cash, as somebody wrote.
Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Talking about deep issues, Bill, I know you had a quick read of Roy's essay on his site that I mentioned in the last podcast, the sort of preface to his stuff, his book almost about Stormcock. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, you know, one of the major themes that he talks about in that piece is religion.
Yes.
And it keys in with a movie I just saw that came out in America the last week or two called Religious.
Oh, yeah.
Which is by Bill Maher. Are you familiar with Bill Maher?
Don't know.
No?
Don't think so.
He does a show here. He's a comedian here in America, and he does a show called A Real Time with Bill Maher. It's a panel show where he gets two or three people from the left or the right and the middle, and they come on and they just talk about world politics events and stuff. But he's a comedian, and he's real radical, you know, pretty liberal.
Okay.
And it's on HBO, so he can say, you know, fuck or whatever. And get really, you know, like right now he's really into bashing Palin for being a total bimbo.
Well, yeah.
Stuff. But his movie Religious is a documentary about religion. And it's very much akin to Roy's essay, where he says, and he goes around the world and he asks people about faith and belief and religion and why they believe and why they have faith and this kind of stuff. Because he is one of these logical kind of secularist people that uses reason. He says, I don't understand why the world leaders and a lot of the people that follow them can believe in this mythology of this book that was written a couple thousand years ago about the talking snake and the, you know, the guy that, the god that, you know, sends his son down on a suicide mission.
Yeah.
You know, who's really part of himself and, you know, impregnates the virgin and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that stuff was written a couple thousand years ago by people that were trying to explain a world that we now understand through science and stuff. And yet there's this whole segment of the world that doesn't want to acknowledge that or admit that. And is trying to rewrite history to say, no, this is true. And, you know, there's this huge segment of the population that believes in these myths still, and they're running the country.
It's scary.
And especially the radical ones, like the Bushes and stuff, that believe in the end times and the apocalypse and the other things that are going on. I mean, that's really scary.
Yeah.
And at the, you know, there's a point, I don't want to, you know, spoil the movie, because it'll come out in the UK soon enough, and I highly recommend anybody go see this movie. Religious. It's a combination of religion and ridiculous.
Okay.
Because it's very akin to what I'm thinking and what Roy's thinking and what he's thinking here, is that basically religion is this kind of, you know, I call it a security blanket that most people need. But it's this archaic thing that we had as a species from our childhood that we now have to grow up and out of.
Right.
And if not, we're going to die.
Right.
We're literally going to kill ourselves off if we don't grow up and out of it, because we're so going crazy keeping it, hanging on to it, clinging to it, that we're doing stupid stuff. And it's going to be very hard to change that, because the people that are rational, sane human beings that are able to not cling to faith in these things that they grew up with, you know, are few and far between. And they, you know, when you look at how much of the world believes in Jesus or Allah or whatever, you know, it's scary. And the things, you know, the whole history of religion is the history of the state. Statuous exploiters of a catalog of hate, you know, and all the world's wars have been fought over money and God and religion, you know, and you look at the jihads and, you know, all the fundamentalist Christians in this country, it's just
how the hell can we keep doing this? It's amazing to me.
Well, it's just because it's conditioning. It's the people. This is what kills me about, like, people that are very righteous in their religious beliefs. They believe that what they believe in is the truth. They have faith in what they believe in is true, and that their way is right, and that's how they're going to live their life, and that's, you know, what's going to happen in the afterlife, etc., and that their way is right and other people's way is wrong. The problem with that is that if they were born in China, they believe that Chinese way. You know what I mean? You know, and if they were born in India, they might believe in Hinduism. So, you know, it just makes no sense to me that all these different people born in all over the world would believe so many different things. And they can't all be right, you know what I mean? In the movie, Bill Maher's like, well, why doesn't God, if he's all-powerful, just tell us all, you know, at the same time, which is the right religion, you know, instead of just having, you know, picking some guy and having him go out in the woods or up on a mountain and say, here's the right truth, you know, and then go tell the people. You're the messenger. Go tell the people. Why don't you just say, hey, everybody, here's the right religion, Shinto. Shinto is the right religion, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, so there's so many great parts in this movie where he just, you know, kind of picks apart the logic of religion and all the mythology of it and all the ways that it, you know, stole from other ancient pagan religions. And it sounds great.
Yeah,
it would be hilariously funny. I mean, you kind of laugh until you cry because it's so funny until you just start thinking about how scary it is that we're still living in this kind of infantile, juvenile kind of existence when we should be so much more evolved, you know. And when getting back to Roy's essay, you know, he talks about 40 years ago in Stormcock having these kind of more evolved thoughts about, okay, we realize we're fucking up the planet. We realize that religion has been this constriction on our mental and intellectual evolution for the last 2,000 years. You know, now that we realize these things, aha, let's change it and make it better. 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, 40 years later, has it gotten better? No, it's gotten worse.
Yeah.
You know, that's his frustration, my frustration. It's like those of us who are aware and awake and, you know, thinking with just a little bit of reason and logic and, you know, not, we're questioning authority, but we're also, you know, we're looking at it with an open mind, an open heart, and saying, look, I've heard your side. I've heard your side. I've thought about it. I'm not dissing you or just dismissing you just because of what you believe. I'm listening to you, and I don't believe in this because it takes this leap of faith, which has all this irrational stuff that was written 2,000 years ago by people that weren't even there 200 years when this guy Jesus walked the earth. You know what I mean? And as a historian, I've looked into the Jesus story as a historian talking about the man who lived then. You know, and there's a big difference between the man who lived 2,000 years ago, the historical figure, and what the church wrote about 200 years later and all the stuff that's happened since then. You know what I mean? So, you know, with Roy's thing, I'm getting a little sidetracked here, but with Roy's thing, it's like we're so frustrated that we're looking at the world, you know, compassionately, humanely, rationally, educatedly, I'd say, and going, come on, people, can't you see that there's basic human things that we need to do and fix now? And this is what he's saying in 71, 81, 91, 2001. He'll be saying in 2011, God willing. And it's like, no, the people that are living on faith, irrationally, by greed, in power, are going to continue to fuck us all over in the name of God, money, and power. It's just like, what the hell do we do? You know, it's very frustrating. Sorry, I'm getting myself a little worked up here.
No, it's good. It's good. Something occurs to me, though, because we've kind of criticized the internet a little bit, but if everybody on the planet has access to tools like that for global communication, won't that help to make people come to their senses because they'll be a bit more aware of what everybody else thinks? Or is that naive?
Well, you know, I thought about that, too. Of course, we all have hoped that the internet can be, and he mentioned that in the essay, too, that maybe the internet can be, these tools can be the great uniter, and, you know, the equalizer that can, you know, educate everyone and unite everyone. And it hasn't been the case so far that we have seen, but we're hopeful that it can be. One of the ideas I had was that, you know, right now we just got totally butt-fucked in America with this tax thing that just happened where they, you know, passed this $700 billion bailout of our bank.
That's right.
You know about this, right?
Yeah.
I'm so upset because as an American taxpayer, I mean, I was upset about this war in Iraq from day one.
Yes.
And it was costing us $24 million a day, $10 billion a month for the last 6 years. And the whole thing added up to about $700 billion in the last 6 years. And I was complaining every year about my tax dollars going to pay for this war.
Yeah.
$700 billion in the last 6 years. Then they spent that much in a week. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
No, I know.
Could I bend over any fucking further? I could not believe this. And then, on top of that, they postured and said, oh, no, we can't have our taxpayers paying for this. They waited a week, and then they passed it with $840 billion. They added another $140 billion in earmarked bullshit for Congress. I mean, every one of those people should be kicked out of there because it's all a bunch of greed and avarice is what it is. So when I think about what taxes, you know, what our taxes are going for, it makes me want to revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't revolt physically because, you know, the powers that be would just, you know, lock us up. But with the internet, are you still there?
Yeah.
Still okay, here. I disconnected.
No, you're fine.
With the internet, I thought, you know, how can we utilize this? Can we have a taxpayer revolt? Can we say, you know, forward email to everyone that you know?
Right.
Let's not pay our taxes this year. What would happen? And I, you know, that's probably pretty subversive. I don't know if they can come, you know, lock me up for that. But, you know, I thought, you know, come April 1st, April Fool's Day, whatever, which happens to be my wedding anniversary, why don't we say, you know, look, we don't want to pay for this bailout of these banks, which is total bullshit. Why don't we say, we're not going to pay our taxes. This is bullshit. We want the Congress to know that this is bullshit. Let's not pay our taxes and see what happens. Now, I don't know. I mean, that might be worse than the whole Wall Street thing, bailout. But it seems like that's the only way that you might get their attention and maybe try to affect some change in Washington. That might be a way the internet could be used as a tool. It does seem like if you forwarded stuff to everyone, that at least maybe half the country that agreed with you might be able to get on board.
It's a little bit unlikely to happen, I think, because of the fear that people have that their cushy lives are going to be taken away from them.
Right. Yeah, that's the problem with revolution is the alternative seems to be, if not anarchy, uncertainty about what do you replace it with, you know. And it's like the Townsend lyric, you know, meet the old boss the same as the new boss, the same as the old boss. It's
yes.
Like, you know, we have democracy, and I believe you guys had an experiment there a couple of centuries back where they, you know, was it Orwell? No, it was Cromwell.
Cromwell.
Where they took over the country, and then they had anarchy and a lot of heads cut off and stuff, right, for a while.
Yeah, so I
believe. I totally know my British history.
Yeah, no, that's...
There were some bad times, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, to put it in a kind of succinct American nutshell.
Yeah.
Or nutcase. They had some bad times during that time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't want to have something like that happen, but it does seem like our system in America, and probably your system in the UK, is very corrupt. And it does
very
seem
much
like
so.
Capitalism has become corrupted by corporate greed.
Completely.
You know, lobbyists in America and corporations have taken over our democracy.
Yes,
and
I have.
I don't see how we can get it back. I do think that if Obama gets elected, that there is hope that we can get our democracy back. Whether he will be co-opted or somehow taken away, I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope not. But there is hope that if he gets elected, we can somehow start to get our democracy back. If he's not elected, then I just think that, you know, it's just, you know, might as well move to Canada or something, because obviously that our government has been stolen. The last two elections were stolen, no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
And it'll definitely be democracy is gone. Very upsetting to me, being that democracy is one of my most cherished principles and what this country is founded on.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing in England. I know that very many people in the UK are frustrated with their government.
Incredibly so.
A lot of people in a lot of the civilized world are very frustrated with the government. The government is very happy to be the government in power and control. And like I said before, as long as they can stay in power and keep the people appeased, entertained, distracted, they'll do it because they can be very happy with what they got, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Question about the internet?
Time will tell, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to start winding up. You've probably got a very sore ear by now.
I'm just getting started.
Well, we'll have to have you back then, won't we? What do you hope for from Roy in the future years? I mean, we found out that he's been ill. He had prostate cancer. He's not been well. He's not getting younger, sadly. Do you think we've had all that we need to get from Roy, or are you hoping for something else?
Well, first, I'm a little bit relieved, because when I first heard about the cancer, just a week or two ago, I think it might have been through a conversation we had, or it might have been from the internet thing, I thought it was a pancreatic cancer, which is really deadly.
Yeah, that is nasty, yeah.
My uncle was one of the only people that had survived that, and so when I thought it was that, I thought, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, so prostate is much more common and much more dealable, and so I'm very hopeful that he'll recover fully from that and live for a couple more decades, hopefully.
Yeah.
So I do wish him the best and a quick recovery and a long life. So, you know, willing, I would hope that he has a long life with Tracy still ahead of him, and I would love to have a sequel to The Green Man or whatever he's willing to do. The last time I interviewed him, he talked about the Seven Ages of Man. I don't know what happened to that. Yeah, I don't know if that's something that is still in his pipeline or if he's moved on to something else. That's fine. I would love to have another album, two or three.
Well, he claims he's got half an album written so far.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, as a fan, you wish for more, but I don't feel he owes us anything more.
Yeah.
I mean, he's given us plenty. Yeah. I really enjoy what he has given us. And I'd be happy with any more albums he's given us that he would be willing to make. You know, I think a lot has to do with the muse. You know, you can't force it.
That's true.
If the muse visits him, and you know, I kind of feel that there's this channel, there's this faucet that opens up. And if he taps into it and it opens up and the muse flows through him and the lyrics come, and the music, the melodies come, you know, it'll happen, and he'll make the music, and he'll release it. And, you know, if it's forced and it's not natural, it won't happen. So if it's meant to happen, it'll happen, and we'll get the music, and it'll go down the way it's supposed to go down. So I'm hopeful we'll get a couple more studio albums. That'd be great. Live albums of current stuff, I could take it or leave it.
Right.
I would love to have an archival release of something circa the mid-70s, like flashes of the Archives of Oblivion, because I know a lot of those 73, 74 shows were taped, obviously, from flashes.
Right.
It'd be great to have they've done a lot of bootleg-type shows nowadays coming out from Neil Young. And
yeah, I'd like to see that.
A whole show.
Yeah.
It'd be great to have a whole show circa, like, 73, or, so you know, like the Maid movie has some stuff footage. Something 72, 71, 73... 74, a whole show, if you had something like that, would be fantastic.
Yeah, it would.
Something like the BBC sessions, but really like a live show would be fantastic. A box set, I think, would be great. I've often made my own fantasy box set for five discs.
Yeah.
Sets that cover his whole career. I think a fan-created box set, you know, even using the internet, where you have suggestions made about what would be the key album tracks, what rarities. There's still some unreleased songs.
There are, yes.
He was making when he was putting out Unknown Soldier, I was begging him to put on, like, you know, Water Sports and that essential track, you know.
Yeah,
and
right.
I think there was some other song.
Goodbye, Ladybird, all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's odds and sods that are still unreleased on CD that could fit on a box set, odd live tracks.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think a box set would be fantastic. Not that it has to be the, you know, the tombstone on the end of your career, right, or anything like that. But that would be a good thing. I'd love to have them come play some more shows in America. But mainly, I would just wish him well and hope that, you know, he can enjoy his days in Ireland with Tracy. I'm so happy that they got married, right?
Yeah.
I'm so happy that they're together, yeah, and that they're happy together and having a good life there in Ireland. You know, I've met her a couple times, and she's such a beautiful person.
Yes, she is.
Inside and out. And yeah. I'm so happy that they're happy together and living their life. I can just totally... I remember watching a little bit of the DVD of her out there in the garden.
Oh, yeah.
You know, knowing how cantankerous he is, you know, I think she's such a good fit for him.
Yeah.
Because she's got a strong will and spirit herself. And so just for the two of them to go at each other and, you know, love and war and all that stuff in between, I think it's great that they have that life together. And, you know, even if they didn't ever put out anything else and just dealt with, you know, surviving in this mad world we live in,
yeah,
and just dealing with, you know, the sight that they have and dealing with, you know, the fans and the stuff they're doing now would be fine with me. Mm. He's given us a lot, and I'm very grateful for what we have, you know.
Yeah. Okay, Bill. Final.
It's sounding way too much like a eulogy. And
well,
a wind-up. I don't want to stop.
No, it's not meant in that way. Not meant in that way.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say that we haven't covered yet, or any sort of message you want to put out there for people?
Let me think here. I covered his album. we didn't really talk about his albums that much. You know, one thing I thought was pretty cool was I once read somewhere, you know, his first album, there's a new record of, there's a new issue of Record Collector magazine, you know that magazine? That talks about the 200 most collectible UK albums.
Oh, right.
And did you know one of Roy's made it in there?
Oh, was it the Strike label one?
Yeah, the Strike Sophisticated Beggar.
Yeah.
That made it in there. I think it said about 325 UK pounds in mint shape, which is, I think, around $700 US. I'm not sure. But one thing I read about that, which is, you know, it's one of the Holy Grail albums, I don't have, is that I once read that when they found Jimi Hendrix's record collection, that album was in there.
I've heard that as well, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it makes sense because Chaz Chandler brought Hendrix to the UK in the fall of 66.
Mm.
And that, you know, album was released, I've heard, either December 66 or January 67. You know for sure?
No.
Yeah, I think it's early 67 myself.
Yeah.
And the label that's come out since then credits 67.
Right.
Roy cites it 67. So I'm thinking early 67, which is around the time that he was recording his first album. So it would make sense that, you know, him being a big Dylan fan, you can kind of see a Dylan influence on the sleeve,
yes,
and all that he might have picked that up early in his days in England. He would be there in London when that album came out, and that's probably one of the places he could have picked it up at the time. So I think it's pretty cool that, you know, one of Jimi Hendrix's 400 records was the first Roy Harper album.
It is, isn't it?
I would love to have, you know, Jimi Hendrix's copy of The Sophisticated Beggar.
Yeah, that would be something.
And just, you know, thinking about the Roy Harper albums, I just love every one of his records to different degrees, you know. His Harvest UK albums, I think, are just some of the best sounding records ever made. I highly recommend it if anyone can ever pick those up in the original UK pressings. I think they blow away every other US pressing.
And much better than CD, in your view, then.
Yeah. And actually, the New Zealand pressing I have of the Stormgawk is an amazing sounding record to me, too. So, you know, if you can find the UK pressings of the records, I think that they're worth picking up. And all the vinyl up through Once and Burn the World is, you know, I have it all, and it's fantastic stuff. One of my dreams would be if I had ever, you know, hit the lotto or enough money to, you know, release stuff on my own, is I would do a vinyl release of Death or Glory. The original cover and version.
Yeah.
Because that was the first one not to come out on vinyl.
Yes, that's right.
I would put that out with permission of the original cover, double gatefold, with all the original tracks, you know, and a nice audio file pressing. And that would be nice to have that in Dream Society and Green Man all out on vinyl.
Yeah.
That'd be great. So. And I always look whenever I'm out and about to see what Roy Harper albums are, or CDs actually. There's never any vinyl anywhere around here on the West Coast, but what CDs are in the racks. And nice to say that.
Yeah, I do that.
Yeah. There's only one or two CDs out there, but, you know, big fan of the man, what can I say?
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Okay, Bill. Well, thank you very much indeed. I really enjoyed talking to you, and you're what I would call an extremely erudite American. So, thank you.
Is that like a stewardess?
No. What?
Erudite? Erudite. Flies well? What?
Yeah. It mean, no, 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 no. It means it,
aerodynamic.
Able to talk well and intelligently. Okay.
I always wondered what that word meant because I see it used a lot, and I was like, I think I want to use that word. I don't know what it means, though, but it sounds good.
Okay. Well,
well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to hearing this. And
yeah,
I've really appreciated all you've done over the years with both your sites.
Oh, thanks, Bill.
I've always had a great time on the old one that I enjoyed so much.
Yeah.
Met a lot of great people on there.
Well, yeah.
Some have become fast friends, and I really appreciate all you've done. Obviously, it's your passion, and you're doing a great job with it. And I've had a great time.
Okay.
I hope I haven't rambled on.
not at all. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, say hi to Roy and all the fans over there, and maybe someday we'll meet.
Let's hope so.
On Tom Tiddler's ground.
Okay. Cheers, Bill.
All right. Take it easy.
So that was the second and final part of our interview with Bill Musial. Thank you so much, Bill. I really enjoyed talking to you. Old timers on the Stormcop mailing list will know Bill from a few years back. Unfortunately, he left the online music communication side of things for various reasons a while back, and I just wanted to say publicly, Bill, if you wanted to come back and start talking crap with us again, you'd be more than welcome. So now it's the A to Z of Harper. It's the letter P, and what I've chosen is a track called Playing Prison. So you get two P's for your money there. That's off the no longer available Loony on the Bus album, which was a kind of mixture and hodgepodge of stuff. It included some tracks from the then unavailable Commercial Breaks, and also some other odd snippets. And Playing Prison is kind of a lost gem, I think, off that album, along with Burn the World Part 1. It's about looking back at a relationship, and it's a very personal, Roy-ish song. It's about something that's gone wrong and how you deal with that moving forward.
When you say that I have done it before, so it should come easy now. Well, come the day when we show us to the door, there'll be sorrow throwing shadows. And then I think of why I'm leaving again, why I'll never settle down, loath to further so-called civilization, growing sorrow, throwing shadow. Anyhow,
I have met children somewhere in the world outside the ark, somewhere in the world, here and there, I always left them somewhere in the world, like you said, I left my mark. Just a trace, forever leaving, and it sure comes easy now, from a place I disbelieve in, growing sorrow, throwing shadow.
That was Playing Prison from Loony on the Bus. Now, some feedback. Once again, I have no audio feedback. Please, please, please send me an MP3 or call into the voicemail number that I'll give later on. But I'll read a couple out. I had a really nice email from a guy called Keith Bedford. Keith actually has just discovered the podcast, and I find that really encouraging. Somebody that hasn't been listening from the first one. And he says, "Dear Paul, just a quick note to say I have recently discovered your Roy podcast on iTunes and thoroughly enjoyed the first one and look forward to listening to the rest. Making the most unpleasant daily journey from Basingstoke to Reading and back, something to look forward to for a change. As an ageing music fan of 56 years, I first saw Roy performing at Les Cousins in the late 60s and have been following ever since, seeing him many times live. Last gig I saw him at was about 4 years ago in Hebden Bridge. He was in fine form and went down a storm. Okay, thanks a lot for carrying the torch for one of our most talented and revered songwriters. I know you're not a fan of Bob, but Roy is up there with Bob Dylan and Loudon Wainwright III, the three of them being my Father, Son and Holy Ghost." He wrote some more, but anyway, thank you, Keith. When you've actually caught up with the podcast, which might take you a little while, hopefully you'll hear this and it will make you laugh. Okay. I had some general feedback about Bill's interview, but of course people are waiting to hear all of it. I made a little comment on the forums and said, "Americans can really talk, can't they?" in reference to the fact that the interview ran long. And I had a couple of very confused responses from two Americans, actually. So, hello to Paula and No Celebrity. Bob Jacobs said, "Well, old Bill did you proud. Loved his anecdote about his trip to Ireland. Looking forward to the next episode, Bob." Well, okay, thanks, Bob. I hope you enjoyed the second part. And finally, I had a really good, thought-provoking, brilliant email from Elliot Knapp. And I think I have to read most of it, actually, because I'm hoping this will get some discussion going. He says, "I really enjoyed the latest podcast. Your interview with Bill is interesting, both because he's a rare breed of Harper fan, American, and also because he's taken his interest in music in an academic direction. Plus, we both travelled from the US to see Roy, although I didn't try and track down his house. Bill's take on Roy's place in history is thought-provoking, especially with regards to Roy being the heir to Dylan's surrealistic poetry, though I'd have to hear a bit more evidence linking Dylan's poetry, which is full of cultural references and seeming non-sequiturs, with Roy's intensely personal, more abstract poetry before buying that completely. On the subject of hero worship, I'm a little troubled when fans of a lesser-known artist confidently declare someday the world will recognise him for the genius he was. I know it's frustrating for the fans that Roy's name isn't more widely known, but I don't think he needs widespread acceptance for the quality of his contribution to be validated. In fact, I think it's a bit of a stretch to claim that he'll ever be widely recognised, considering his aggressive anti-religious stance and frequent irreverence, which some people find uncomfortable and off-putting. Not everyone is interested in being intellectually challenged when they put an album on, and Roy will never appeal to those people. Rather than fantasise about a world where Roy is always mentioned in the same breath as Dylan, I'd prefer to measure his success by the intensity of his existing fanbase's interest, and perhaps by his critical reputation, which has been overwhelmingly positive. If Roy never receives worldwide acclaim for his work, it's no less credible, and the depth of ideological connection his fans feel is no less powerful. What does bother me is that there are definitely many people who would enjoy Roy's music but haven't ever gotten the chance simply because they've never heard his name. Finally, I found Bill's interview personality very much at odds with his often bombastic mailing list personality. I'll be awaiting the second half of the interview to see if you discuss his contributions there and whether or not he'll be returning. Well, Elliot, that was a great email. I wish you'd recorded you saying these things rather than have me read out your words. But the thing about the hero thing, I think when you get to appreciate what's called a cult musician, you kind of take them under your wing almost and start to think, well, this guy really doesn't need to be appreciated more. And it does come across as a kind of bit of a fervour, and it's quite off-putting for people, actually. And your points are well made, and I agree that the measure of success certainly isn't global domination in the music market. Far from it, in fact. I think we all agree with that. But I still wish that Roy had got more well-known, again, for the reasons you've said, because people need to hear some of what he says. Talking of people needing to hear some of what he says, I have to say some fairly strident things at this point. The podcast has a presence on MySpace. I have an account on there under the name of the podcast, and MySpace is a very popular networking tool for people in the music industry, and I get a lot of friend requests from artists that want to spread their word around, as well as Harper fans, of course, and people who are interested in podcasting in general. And I got a friend request last week from something I won't name, but it was basically a kind of white supremacy movement, and they said, please add us to your friends and you should play our audio message on your podcast. So I went off and listened to the audio message, which was an hour long bunch of fucking bullshit racist crap claptrap bollocks, and I'm sorry you people, I don't imagine you will ever listen to this podcast, because it's quite evident that you have no interest in what we actually talk about and the ideas and everything. You've just basically picked every podcast you could find and asked them to play your shit. But there's no fucking way. You can piss right off. Neanderthals, you've got no intelligence and no interest in people. All you want to do is play on people's bigotry. And I'm sorry, as you can tell. Oh, Jesus. I went off to look at their web page, and I did some background research and found out all about what they believe in, and the fact the person that started their movement had actually been in prison for murder. And you just don't get it, do you? And well, yeah, rant over there. We just have time for some credits and copyright messages and so on. It's the end of 2008. We're heading into 2009. The next episode will be out around January the 1st, depending on how bad the New Year's Eve hangover is. But I'd just like to say at this point, thank you so much for the last year's feedback and general encouragement that I've had for the podcast. And in particular, I'd like to thank everybody that's done a donation. There's a couple of you in particular who've been donating fairly regularly. You know who you are. I won't name names, but thank you, really. It helps an awful lot. it does cost quite a lot to host the podcast and do all this stuff, and you know, it really helps and it's encouraging. I'm not trying to put a guilt trip on those of you that can't afford to pay or, you know, have got better things to do with your money, but thanks anyway. Copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others freely, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by a kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. The introduction music is by kind permission of Adam Leonard, and you can find more about Adam at the show notes. If you want to help the podcast in a non-monetary way, then please go on to iTunes, if you use iTunes, and send in some feedback about the podcast or rate it. Just do a search for Roy Harper Podcast and you'll find us on there. If you do want to make donations, there's a PayPal button on stormcock.net. If you want to send in some feedback, obviously email or forum postings are fine, but if you do feel like sending in an audio contribution, which I would love, then you can call 01223 850282 in the UK and leave a short voicemail. Or you can, if you're overseas, call +44 1223 850282, or email me an MP3 or whatever audio format you care to, actually, pd@stormcock.net. And with that, I think we're finished for this month. So once again, happy Christmas, happy New Year. Let's hope for all of us 2009 is a good year, and I'll be speaking to you next year. Bye for now.
Hey, people on the radio.
Can we get a quick station ID from you?
Yeah. Hey, people out there listening to the radio.
I'll write it down really fast.
Right up here, K Otter 94.9 FM.
Yeah, there you go.
K Otter 94.9 FM. And you got to say Cambria San Luis Obispo.
Hey, what?
Cambria, San Luis Obispo.
Cambria.
That's a legal
Cambria.
Idea.
You can say Cambria.
Way, yeah. But then San Luis Obispo makes it legal.
Idea. It's legal without it, but it sounds good as it, too. Okay. Yeah.
San
Luis Obispo.
San Luis Obispo. Okay. Christ, I've been there. Yeah. Okay. This is Roy Harper, and you're listening to K Otter, San Luis Obispo.
94.9 FM.
94. I thought that was a date.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, again. You're listening to K-Otter 94.9 FM, Cambria, San Luis Obispo, and this is Roy Harper, and thank you very much, and hang in there. This is K-Otter Cambria, 94.9, and you're listening to Roy Harper.
Would you say one for my show?
Yeah.
I play a lot of your songs in there, so if you'd say, hey, this is Mr. Bill, this is Roy Harper, and you're listening to Mr. Bill's Wild Ride on K Otter.
Hey, this is Roy Harper, and you're listening to Milk. You're Black Kid.
That's wild.
Hey, this is Roy Harper, and you're listening to K Otter on 94.9, and this is Wild Bill.
Mr. Bill's Wild Ride.
Oh, Mr. Bill's Wild Ride. Right, we should have this written down.
Yeah.
This is Roy Harper on K Otter 94.9 and Cambria, St. Louis Obispo, and why so many things?
Because stupid Mr. Bill's playing Roy Harper again.
Okay. Oh, right.
You'd say something like, why the hell is Mr. Bill playing Roy Harper again? Or something like that.
Why the hell is Mr. Bill playing Roy Harper again?
That's right. That's perfect.
That's good.
Yeah. I'll let you go now. I feel awkward. Yeah.